I'm Dr. Howard Zucker, the doc in docology. It was one of those moments that you just don't forget. We were sitting around the dinner table, my kids laughing, talking about school, just a normal evening. And then one of them suddenly paused, looked up and said, "My stomach hurts." And then minutes later, vomiting. And in that moment, I wasn't just dad, I was a pediatrician. And I knew exactly what was happening. This was not a stomach bug. It wasn't a picky eaters protest. And we have our picky eaters in the house. It was a food allergy reaction. And we're not alone. 6 million children in the United States, that's about 8%, have food allergies. And that's roughly 2 kids in every classroom. Now, these days, you see it everywhere. There are food label warnings about shared equipment with peanuts and tree nuts and sesame. And the restaurant menus with these bolded notices, like, right? Nut-free facility. The awareness is growing, but so is the problem. So what's going on here? Why are food allergies becoming so common? And what can we do about it? Well, today's guest is someone who's been at the forefront of this issue for decades. Dr. Scott Sichera is the director of the Chaffee Food Allergy Institute at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York, and the author of The Complete Guide to Food Allergies in Adults and Children. And he's also my child's allergy doctor. So welcome to the podcast. It is great to see you. And not in a hospital setting. I am sure with all the pollen in the air, there are kids, many kids with itchy eyes out there this time of year. My kids are 2 of them. Though this is a different type of allergy from, you know, what our topic is today. So I thought we could start with the big picture. CDC says that food allergies have increased by 50% over the past few decades. So my question really is, what causes these food allergies to develop in the first place? Is it genes? Is it environment? Or is it both? And I thought maybe you could tackle that upfront.
Well, first of all, Howard, thank you very much for this invitation. It's really a pleasure to be on Docology, and this is such a great program, such a great series of podcasts. So congratulations on all of that. And it's really an honor to be here today. So to address your question, I mean, that is like sort of the million-dollar question. Why are we seeing this increase? When we think about it, it's always genetics and environment. You know, food allergies run along with other allergic illnesses. People whose families have hay fever or allergic rhinitis, eczema, asthma, you see food allergies in families with that as well. When you look at specifically food allergy, you know, that's part of this atopic march or atopic group of diseases, allergic group of diseases. We looked, when I started, back in 1997, we looked at like how many people in the U.S. have a peanut allergy, and we did one of these random telephone call things where, you know, you're eating dinner and suddenly someone's on the phone asking you questions. And we found for children, there was 1 out of 250 were reporting a peanut allergy. We repeated that study 5 years later. It was 1 in 125. And 6 years after that, it was 1 in 70, over 1%, just with peanut allergy. And I thought our data was wrong. Like maybe it was the same methods, but did something change how we were doing this? But around the same time, reports coming from Australia, from the UK, and in Canada, other places in the US, were also seeing over 1% just with peanut allergy. When we asked, well, what about the genetics? I did this study looking at shared peanut allergy among identical twins that share all their genes versus siblings who are twins, but not monozygotic, not identical twins. They're more like regular siblings who shared, you know, the womb. And we found that the rate of shared peanut allergy was 7% in the fraternal twins, and it was 2/3 among the monozygotic or identical twins, which tells you that there's a genetic component, but not completely. So environment has to be part of that story.
So is it the ultra clean environments or a challenge that have challenged our immune system? I mean, everyone's washing their hands and, you know, there's hand sanitizer everywhere. Is that tied to, or is it more the microbes that are in our gut? I mean, which one of the, or maybe both? Right?
You're right on target. The leading theory is that our environment, in terms of the germs that live with us, on us, in us, are different, or our cleanliness, the hygiene hypothesis, the cleanliness that has occurred is probably given our immune system sort of a jolt in an odd direction. You know, our immune system was set up to fight infection, and suddenly there are less things around. And when it comes to allergy in particular, it's sort of the same mechanisms that cause allergy are those that fight parasite types of infections. And so, you know, we're living in a non-parasitized community. My breakfast food comes in, you know, like a breakfast bar. There's no germs in there. It can last for years. We use dishwashers. We clean everything. So there's a lot less of that. And we've done some studies showing that the communities of bacteria may be different. People who have allergies, don't have allergies, have specific ones and the like. So that's a big part of it. People who grow up on farms have less allergy than people who live in the cities. As countries become industrialized, you see the allergy rates go up. And food allergy follows all of those stories. I don't think that's the entire answer. There are other theories having to do with vitamins, our nutrition in general, our skin and gut barriers that may be affected by various chemicals in the environment. But it is a big part of the story, this hygiene hypothesis.
So basically these antibacterial soaps, the antibiotics, the processed food, maybe the pollution in the environment, all of that sort of comes to play. And then you have this genetic predisposition maybe that's set up, and then the next thing you know, everything sort of has a perfect storm in some ways. Because, you know, as a kid, I used to run around in the country in the Catskills, my hands in the dirt and everything. And I was an allergic kid, but somehow, like, you go out there, you pick the blueberries off of the vine, you eat them, you didn't wash them, you just took them, you ate them. So let's say you're a parent and you're worried about your kid, like I worry about my kid, you have an allergy, or maybe you're even an adult and you have a strange reaction to something. What comes next? Like, what's the workup? What do we do? Do we need skin testing, blood testing? Like, how do we address this now that we've said, okay, here's the problem. What do we do?
Yeah, so we definitely use the test that you just mentioned. The skin testing, which has been around sort of forever, is just these little scratch tests. So an extract of the food is put on the surface of the skin, a little scratch is made, and you look for a mosquito bite-like reaction, a little what we call a wheal and a redness around it. The blood test is measuring something we call IgE antibody. Actually, both of those tests are. IgE antibodies, I like to think of as like antenna that are able to see what you're allergic to. And these antenna sit on the surface of allergy cells and look for the food. So when you've eaten the food, it says, uh-oh, there's the peanut. It tells the allergy cell to release chemicals. And then the chemicals are what give you those allergic symptoms. So the tests that we have look for those specific antennas or IgE antibodies. It looks for the size of the bump from the skin test. And we also can do a test called the fancy name is oral food challenge. It's really a medically supervised feeding test. So if you're not sure whether there's an allergy or not, we will do a gradual feeding of the food to see if the person has symptoms or not. Now, the most important test among all the tests available, drum roll please, is actually the conversation, the history. As you know, getting the medical history is the most important. So people often come into my office, put out their arm to get a skin test or a blood test, tell me what I'm allergic to. But these tests are not like a pregnancy test. It's not like a yes or no test. They're statistical tests. There's a lot of nuance to them. And they often can be positive in someone who can eat the food anyway. And so the story, what happened to you when you ate it? How quickly after you ate it did this happen? What were the foods that were eaten? I then put together epidemiology associated with the foods, my knowledge about the symptoms, and a whole bunch of other stuff before even deciding what to test for.
Which is really critically important. Quick issue, the food allergies and food intolerance, because sometimes people say, oh, I have a food allergy, but in actual fact, it's probably food intolerance. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, the diagnosis and the difference on that.
Yeah, so the medical description of a food allergy means an adverse immune response to typically the protein in the food. And so that's different than an intolerance that does not really involve the immune system. So all the stuff we talked about earlier about how the immune system fights infections, the immune system could cause autoimmune disease. You know, people are familiar with things like arthritis and lupus that are autoimmune. Different than the immune system being involved, intolerance involves everything not the immune system. And so the most common example is lactose intolerance. And that results from a deficiency or absence of an enzyme that digests the sugar that's in milk. Now, most of the world's population has that problem, so it's actually essentially the norm to not be able to digest it well. But if you can't digest it well, then you end up with bloating and gas and discomfort from milk products. And it's not the immune system, it's the digestive issue. Many people have an intolerance of alcohol. And so they are lacking alcohol dehydrogenase, and that deficiency gives you things like flushing or vomiting or pain from ingesting alcohol that you then have trouble digesting and end up sort of poisoned by it. And so these are different than the allergies, and they can be, you know, very troubling, but they don't lead to severe immediate allergic reactions like anaphylaxis, the word we put on that, where symptoms such as the vomiting you mentioned before, hives, swelling, trouble breathing, asthma type symptom reactions, and the heart could be affected with poor circulation. Very different.
So good to tease out, talk to your doctor, try to make sure you know which, if it's food intolerance, and if not, then maybe food allergy. And that's for kids and adults, obviously.
And there could be other things that make people sick from food, right? Bacterial food poisoning. And there are some kinds of food poisoning look just like an allergic reaction. When dark meat fish like tuna or mahi-mahi spoils, it can put out chemicals that are like the allergy chemicals that give you a reaction that looks like an allergy, and yet it was a toxin.
Thank you for making that point. Great point about that, to make sure we don't just think it's just two possibilities. There's the million-dollar question that every parent wants to know. Is there a way to prevent food allergies in the first place? And you know, as a child, when your child is an infant, or even during pregnancy when mom's pregnant, are there prenatal exposures? Does breastfeeding help, right? C-section versus vaginal delivery, all of these things I'm sure come up. And so I wonder, maybe you could sort of tease those apart a little bit for everyone.
Yeah, so let me start with the last part that you mentioned, C-section versus vaginal delivery. So that kind of, that's not something you could typically control, right? It's not something like you have a so much of a choice over, but there's a theory, there's some data suggesting that C-section delivery is associated with more allergy. There are counter examples, and it's not 100%, but it fits this theory that if you're born through the vaginal canal, you're kind of coated with bacteria and other things that might start to give you those communities of bacteria that might actually be beneficial in the long run. And so we're actually doing a study where we are we're randomizing babies born by C-section who are at risk of allergy based on family history to actually coat them with some of their mother's vaginal secretions to try to see if we can make a difference with that. So that intervention study is playing off of this idea of the microbiome, the community of bacteria. But in terms of prevention, you mentioned some other things, and you know, one of them is about breastfeeding in general. Well, there's tons of reasons to breastfeed. There isn't great information saying that breastfeeding specifically prevents food allergies. In terms of diet, so it's recommended, but it's not a specific thing for food allergy. In terms of diet in general, this is sort of both great news and sort of maybe disappointing in a way, but there isn't really a study saying that something that moms eat or don't eat are going to cause or prevent a specific food allergy. Like, oh my gosh, I think I ate too much peanut or something like that, or not enough peanut, whatever it might be. There's not so much evidence for that. But healthy diets in the mom, Mediterranean type diets, healthy fats. I mean, it sounds kind of like simplistic, but those types of things, a diverse and healthy diet, probably do make a difference in terms of reduced allergy outcomes. But the one of the biggest recommendations now is actually the opposite of what people were being told over 20 years ago. So when I started, the first recommendations that I knew of for this were saying, if you're allergy prone, don't give your baby peanuts until age 3, fish until age 3, egg until age 2, milk until age 1. These were like, when I saw these recommendations as a young allergist, like, oh my gosh, you know, where did that come from? And that means no birthday cake for a baby who may have been totally healthy, right? Prevention. So just a number of years later, I actually got involved with the American Academy of Pediatrics, and we rescinded all of that because it was not showing up in various studies that that was really doing the trick. And studies came out of Israel identifying that in Israel, they had these peanut snacks, and babies were generally getting them early, Bamba, exactly. And because they were, or it was thought that maybe because they were getting them in the first year of life and had less peanut allergy, and in the US, in the UK, Australia, people were mostly not giving these types of products until kids were 2 or 3 years old. Maybe that earlier exposure made a difference. And so a formal study was done through in the UK, randomizing babies at high risk for developing peanut allergy, determining that they didn't currently have it. But if they were prone to it and didn't currently have it from 4 to 11 months of age, they randomized to eat peanut early in infant-safe forms or to avoid it. And there was an 80% reduction in peanut allergy. And with that very convincing information, along with some additional studies, some studies that also found a similar kind of improvement for egg allergy with early egg introduction, the U.S. Guidelines really changed and are now encouraging early exposure in infant-safe forms. Again, I'll say, because peanuts obviously are a choking hazard. Peanut butter is too thick to, you could choke a baby with peanut butter. But by smoothing it out, infant-safe forms, getting them in, not treating them differently than you would treat cereals or fruits or vegetables, and having them as part of the diet, that's what the current recommendations are, not to delay on these foods. And the reason that probably works is you're basically giving the immune system what it might expect to see in the way it might expect to see it, in the mouth, into the gut, and there's a gut immune system that's ready for that. If you're not if you're not eating the food and you're a baby who's prone to allergy, maybe you have eczema, the skin barrier is full of rash, it's broken down, people around you are eating the foods, now the food is settling from the environment onto the skin of the rash, inflamed skin for the baby with eczema, and they're not eating it, that may be exactly the formula for the opposite effect, that you're getting them more and more hyped up with an allergic response without letting their immune system see it in a good way.
So I basically you're priming the immune system early on to get them able to handle some of these allergies or potential allergies up front. I want to go back for a minute, and I gave my kids Bamba exactly to decrease the risk of a peanut allergy. I want to jump back just for a second because you mentioned that study that they're doing about babies born by C-section. When are we going to hear some results from that?
It'll probably be about another year.
Another year? Okay.
We're doing that right here at the Jaffe Food Allergy Institute at Sinai. It's a single center study, but we're exploring it.
That's a fascinating. That's really fascinating.
There's also studies going on giving babies mixes of probiotics of you know, ones that are considered that they might have a preventative effect. So there's a lot of interest in this area.
Right. Quick question on the issue of what's happening in Washington. So the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert Kennedy, is speaking about these food additives. Can they contribute to food allergies? Do we know? And will we have any information about that as we start to study a little bit more about the additives that have been put into a lot of kids' foods that they're consuming?
From an allergic reaction standpoint, most of these additives are small molecule chemicals that aren't seen by the immune system. So the IG I was talking about before isn't really at play. There have been studies suggesting, you know, some people get rashes. It may be some kind of a chemical effect for some people. There are food color agents that are made out of protein. So, for example, annatto is a seed that is used as a coloring agent in food, that's a protein. And we do see some people have allergic reactions. So that's a rare allergen, but that's an example where it's more of a protein.
Right, got it. So we spoke a little bit about diagnosis, prevention. My next question is a little bit about management and treatment. So as a parent, right, you worry about these issues. At the end of the day, you really want to know, what do I need to do? How do I manage this? Because my kids, you know, my kid is exposed to birthday parties, school lunches, and so you worry, and you're always reading the labels. What do we do? How do we manage? And then can our kids outgrow this as well? I mean, yeah. We can get to that.
So, you know, once a diagnosis is made, and, you know, it's a whole process for that, or if there's been an allergic reaction and you've identified the foods, the primary initial management is really don't eat the food, right? So it's pretty straightforward. It sounds ridiculously simple, but it is not simple to actually do because of, you know, a whole bunch of reasons why you might accidentally ingest the food. So First of all, you already mentioned teaching people about reading labels. So our labeling laws in the U.S. cover the major food allergens. So that's milk, egg, wheat, soy, peanuts, tree nuts, fish, shellfish, and sesame. In that, if those are ingredients in a product, it has to be on the label in plain English, which was actually a great improvement over a while back. So there's laws now that cover those, which is great. You do get a confusion, though, because if you're allergic to something like, let's say, mustard, it's not part of the labeling laws. On the label, it might say spices, and they may not be disclosing that their spice, their special, you know, ingredient was mustard when it says natural flavors. So that's a complication for some people's allergies. And then the other thing that could be confusing about reading labels is advisory labeling. And what do I mean by that? May contain in a facility with, processed on equipment. And so that's all voluntary, and it's hard to assess what the real risk is with that. It's one of these talk to your doctor about it scenarios. If someone's very sensitive to small amounts of the food, then that is something that they may have to worry about and may not be able to eat. And then the other big problem for people with food allergies is restaurants or food service. And so going into a restaurant, I encourage my patients to talk about hidden ingredients and cross contact. What do I mean by that? Someone could say, oh yeah, this is breaded fish. There's no nuts, but yet they may not realize that it's actually crushed pistachio. And so they're not seeing the individual nuts, or there could be a sauce. Cashew is crazy. There's cashew milks, cashew butters, sauces that have cashew in it, cheeses made out of cashew. And it could be really tricky that the server doesn't maybe realize that these are nut products. So very careful. A bowl of salad that was pre-made with some nuts on it. Do you think it's okay to pick the nuts off? We asked restaurants in New York a number of years ago, and 1 in 4 said, yeah, it's okay to pick the nuts off. I mean, if you're someone with a nut allergy, you wouldn't want someone trying to pick the nuts accurately off of a pre-made salad. So a good conversation is necessary.
And then sesame
is tricky too, because so there's sesame seeds. You might see them on a rollers or a cracker, but then there's tahini, which is a sauce that may be hidden in something. It's solid sesame paste. It's actually very high in sesame. One drop of tahini is like 60 sesame seeds worth of protein. So it could make someone very sick and be a hidden ingredient. So these are all nuances they have to learn about, in addition to how to recognize and treat an allergic reaction. And then you asked about outgrowing the allergies. And the good news is that most children will outgrow allergies to things like milk or egg or wheat or soy. Unfortunately, still a good number don't. And those statistics seem to have worsened over the years in terms of it's maybe harder to outgrow it nowadays. But still most will outgrow those. But then peanuts, about 20% outgrow. And tree nuts, fish or shellfish are probably in the category of about 10 or 15% outgrow it. So we could keep our fingers crossed and hope for that, but unfortunately, a lot of people are going to hold on to those allergies. And you could get an allergy anytime in life also. So an adult can develop a milk allergy. It's unusual, but it could happen. Adults may develop a shellfish allergy.
So the important thing is to figure out what you're at risk for and then sort of see whether you will potentially outgrow it or maybe not. But there's also the whole world of oral immunotherapy. Immunotherapy is a new concept. And maybe you could explain a little bit about how that works and how that can help kids and adults, for that matter, deal with some of the allergies that they may have.
Yeah, so right now there are only 2 FDA-approved therapies for food allergy, and one of them is a peanut oral immunotherapy. So what does that mean? It means giving a very small amount of the food, an amount that is almost, you know, dust amount, that you hopefully can get into the mouth and swallow without having an allergic reaction to the very small amount, ingesting that amount like every day for a couple of weeks or more, and then coming back to the doctor. All this is done under doctor supervision, going back to the doctor and under supervision, having a bit larger amount, eating that every day for 2 weeks and so on. That particular treatment, this peanut oral immunotherapy, aims for the person eventually being on about one peanut kernels worth of peanut. And the studies there's about a 2/3 success rate of making it through the process, and being protected to two or more peanuts, something that many of our patients call bite safe. So they're worried about a small accident. This would be making them bite safe from a small accident. Now, that approach has been generalized in allergy practices across the globe to other foods, not FDA approved approach, but it is done in many practices. We do it here also at Mount Sinai to provide the same type of treatment. There are risks and benefits. Allergic reactions are the main risks. And sometimes people will get an inflammation in their gut from trying to constantly eat a food that they're allergic to, something we call eosinophilic esophagitis. But the benefit is to be able to have this extra safety. And for some people, they're able to get up onto larger amounts, even meal-sized portions. It's not curative for most people. If they stop taking the food as medicine, with time, they will typically gradually go back to being allergic again. But that's what the process is. It's trying to get the immune system, let's call it, used to it. We do see changes in the immune system, and then, you know, for, again, the majority of people, we could get them onto at least some amount of the food.
So you teach the immune system to become less reactive over time. But like anything else, if you forget to keep teaching it, then it will maybe revert back and you'll have a reaction. So every once in a while, someone forgets. They don't realize that they took something. So then the issue is, how do you protect them? That brings up the whole world of, right, the EpiPen, right? And so to make sure that those are around, I have mine. I keep one in the car. I keep one in the house, obviously. And it's very interesting because when you have a child with it, you're always a little bit on guard, worrying about that. So what are some of the other things one can do to make sure, like, you can have an allergy action plan? And then also maybe you could talk a little bit about what's new, because I know in 2024, Xolair, which is a medication, the FDA approved a medication to help with this. So I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about what are the best ways to deal with this if you do have a child or an adult that has an allergy?
Yeah, so let me start with the epinephrine, because I feel like there's some mystique about it. I think some people like their brain goes to Pulp Fiction or something, and there's like this giant shot, and it's terrifying to some people. But as you may know, epinephrine was used to treat asthma before the days of having, you know, inhaled medications for asthma. It's like, hey, doc, my asthma, here's your injection. Great. I feel better. Thanks, doc. Hey, it's been half an hour, doc. It's coming back. Here's another shot. Thanks, doc. This is great. So I think it just being a mystique about it, people are like, oh my gosh, I hope I don't have to use that epinephrine. But it's a great medication for a serious allergic reaction. What does it do? It makes the lungs open up so you can breathe easier. It helps actually to reduce some of the hives and things like that. But also importantly, it keeps the heart beating strong and supports blood pressure. So it does everything that might be going sour in a significant allergic reaction. And for first aid management of an allergic reaction, which is why people are carrying these medicines around, that the more prompt it's used, the better off you are. I mean, the horror stories about food allergy are often associated with like a teenager who is denying their symptoms, go to the bathroom, don't tell anyone what's going on, hoping it'll go away. And then they didn't use their epinephrine promptly. So using it promptly is really important. It's a little ouchy, but the side effect is it might make your heart beat a little faster, but so does running. And it might make you a little jittery, but so does coffee. So, you know, it's a really safe thing to use. One of the things that people mishear, and, you know, I've never said to a patient, if you use your epinephrine, you have to go to the emergency room. I've never said that to a patient. But when I tell patients this, you know, use it promptly, it helps you, et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, if you're having a bad allergic reaction, you should probably get to an emergency room because they have more medicines, they can monitor you. Sometimes symptoms come back and they might come back worse. That's the place to be. They have oxygen, all this other stuff. Sometimes with the family or individual hears is, ooh, there's something about that epinephrine that makes you go to an emergency room. Nope. You go to the emergency room because of the allergic reaction. So this mystique is sometimes, I think, mishearing why you're going to an emergency room. It's not about the good, safe medicine that you used. Now you showed, so the word EpiPen is actually a brand name. And you actually showed a different brand, which is an AviQ, which is a talking item. And we kind of use the word EpiPen kind of like we say, hey, give me a Kleenex. You know? But there are several different device types that have injectors. And I tell my families, you know, it's very important. Sometimes insurance covers a different one than you expect. You can always look at a video, how to use it. I teach my patients when to use it, which is when there's more than mild symptoms. But you have to identify that with your own physician as to when there is to use it. And again, you know, going to the emergency room has to do with having a significant allergic reaction. There's actually a nasal spray epinephrine that was just recently approved, where it's giving you the epinephrine with a one squirt nose spray. It's exactly the device that people use for Narcan, administration of Narcan for an opioid overdose. And so that's actually a non-needle version that's now available as well. So you can talk to your doctor about that as well. So those medications are for an acute allergic reaction and to help keep you, you know, going and give you time to get to an emergency room if you need it. The other medicine that you mentioned is very different. The brand name that you mentioned is Xolair. The medicine is omalizumab. And that medicine actually works differently to try to raise the threshold. So the oral immunotherapy I mentioned before is a treatment that tries to raise your threshold. Well, this injected medication on its own for most people raises thresholds so that they potentially would be bite safe to whatever they're allergic to. That antenna I talked about before floats around in your bloodstream. This injected medication grabs it and gets it, holds on to it like a hug, so it doesn't get to land on that allergy cell I showed you before. And therefore, it's less of a response if you accidentally have the food for most people. It's not a medicine that you're using during an allergic reaction, but it helps to prevent it in case of an accident.
So basically, you don't send out the entire army, you know, and the whole artillery if there's a little skirmish on the battlefield. It's sort of like what happens is you pretty much have a reaction. It doesn't get as bad because the reaction are these immunoglobulins that you were mentioning, the little antennas out there that would go out into the field, but it tempers it a little bit. So
yeah, and by doing that, it makes it a little safer if you have an accident. But we still tell people who are on that medication to avoid the food and to carry their medications.
Not a cure, just decreasing the severity of reactions.
Which is a great step forward. I mean, we've actually been studying this. We've done multiple studies here, and this study, which was an NIAID sponsored study called Outmatch, which we, you know, worked with the company that makes it, put together 10 sites and you know, found that it was effective, and hence the approval.
Although I will say that, you know, and I've experienced this, you got to get your insurance company to cover it. And I've personally had
it's expensive
company, and they've said no, and then appeals. So even though the science is there, we still have to make sure the coverage is there for the families.
Absolutely. And I spent an hour today on the phone talking about that stuff with appeals and with insurance companies.
Yeah, I'm living it right now. So I hear you. The EpiPen, I just do want to mention that in New York State, there was a law that was recently passed saying that you need to have an EpiPen in large public venues. And this was actually a result of a Brooklyn High School student, Lucia Zaremba. So I'm going to do a shout out to her because she was concerned about her sibling, and she pushed this, and kudos to her for pushing this. One day, if I ever meet you, Lucia, I'll tell you about something I did in high school in the same way, writing to my governor to get something to change. So just keep doing that. But that is good because we have AED devices out there, and it's probably good to have EpiPens out there as well. On the policy perspective of things, what should schools be doing? As long as we're talking about kids, you know, and high school kids, but in general, what should schools, what should restaurants, what should workplaces do to make sure that they're prepared for one of these reactions?
Yeah, well, I mean, thanks to advocacy, as you said, there are, you know, laws are gradually changing. I mean, places where people are particularly nervous, for example, our airplanes, where you're, you know, 30,000 feet up and you're in a metal box, and, you know, what if you eat the wrong thing? And, you know, so, you know, maybe there should be more thought about getting, say, food for the airplanes and, you know, different aspects of having self-injectable epinephrine available and trying to reduce overuse of particular foods in different scenarios. In schools, you know, definitely understanding how to prevent the children with allergies from getting a hold of the food they're allergic to, the extra supervision that might be needed, the cafeteria understanding very carefully about creating safe food, having teachers understand how to recognize allergic reactions and treat it if necessary, having the, you know, if there's a school nurse, and hopefully there is, having a plan in place. And you mentioned earlier the action plan. We think of it as an allergy and anaphylaxis emergency plan. It's both in basically like an authorizing the school to treat, but also describes the child's allergies, improves awareness. I think nowadays a lot of schools are, or most every school is really knowledgeable about this, but having approaches to it could vary from school to school. And for the younger children, there might be more supervision needed than for the older children. There used to be this idea of having like a special table. But if you do that, then you have to think about socialization issues. You know, are we never would want to strand a child on their own table because of their food allergy. You know, they should be sitting with their peers. They should be doing everything that the peers are doing, except for eating the food they're allergic to. The schools might need to know about craft projects, right? Like if they're going to suddenly say, well, I think we're going to make peanut butter bird feeders. I don't think I want my peanut allergic five-year-old child to be spreading peanut butter all over pine cones and end up with it on their hands. They touch their eyes, it swells up. If they put it in their mouth, they could have a bigger problem. So, you know, these are things that, you know, sometimes we have to train people about.
So the science is moving, and that's great. It's a lot. What you're saying is communication. Make sure there's a lot of communication at the school level, elsewhere, workplace, and just in general, so that people are aware who's at risk, how to protect it. The science seems to be moving fast. I was curious about two things as a last thing to discuss before we go to some of our audience questions. Vaccines. Are there vaccines that can desensitize the immune system? And also, what about some of the gene therapies that are out there, like the CRISPR gene editing technologies? Will that be something for the future? I mean, I just saw the article about the little child in Children's Hospital of Philadelphia that was treated with genetic therapies to address a metabolic problem, not a food allergy problem.
The question about vaccines, I would broaden to say like other ways to treat food allergy, because omalizumab or Xolair is an example of not really a vaccine, so to speak. But in terms of vaccines, I mean, allergy shots, right, have been around practically forever. You have hay fever, you go and you get an injection. That injection has the protein of, let's say, a birch pollen in it. And you get these shots over months and years, and it helps your hay fever allergy, right? But when people tried that with peanut as a starter, people were having severe allergic reactions from the shots themselves. So one of the strategies with vaccines, actual injections nowadays, is to take parts of the protein so that it doesn't trigger the allergic reaction, but still tries to teach the immune system something, or to add the protein to carriers that would maybe not show it to the allergic system right off the bat, but still allow the immune system to see it and to create helpful responses. But we're also looking at other ways to get the protein safely to the body. One is looking at like a patch, so like a nicotine patch for food, having peanut in the patch, gradually exposing the skin to the peanut is a strategy that's being looked at now and shows promise. Another is to use very low doses of the protein in something called slit or sublingual immunotherapy, giving very trace amounts into the mouth under the threshold of a reaction for most, but to still try to stimulate an immune response. Those aren't like vaccines in the sense of giving an injection, but still. And then there are ways of trying to shut down the cells that respond. And so there are different strategies to try to block those cells that explode and send out the chemicals. And so we're looking at fancy things like combination therapies of muting the allergic responses and trying to get rid of the cells that make the IgE antibodies, a whole bunch of approaches that aren't necessarily food specific. And then your question about CRISPR, I mean, the main thing so far in food allergy is that it's possible to take peanut or take milk and have it created where you knock out or get rid of some of the allergenic proteins. Where that's going to go, I don't know, but so far that's where that's been in the allergy world.
So there's a future out there, and science will keep moving forward, and hopefully we'll learn a lot more. I will say that when I was a little kid and I had allergies, I used to go to get these shots every Sunday, and I'm convinced that's why I liked school, because the weekends weren't the best thing to for me, always a shot. So Mondays were better days. Three takeaways. Before we go to our subscribers and the questions they have out there, can you share three takeaways about food allergies for us?
Yeah, I think one is to get a diagnosis from an allergist, preferably a board certified allergist. A lot of people avoid foods that they don't need to avoid. And some people are not avoiding foods because they haven't gotten the diagnosis and end up with additional allergic reactions. So getting a reliable diagnosis is incredibly important. A second thing is, we talked about management. I mean, people who have a food allergy, it's a huge impact on quality of life. Kids with food allergies are bullied at a higher rate than other children. And so bringing up in a discussion the day-to-day of living with it. There are people who are very, very worried about casual exposure, meaning like they're in a room with peanut or they you know, just get touched by something, and having a severe allergic reaction from those kinds of exposures is incredibly unlikely. Having those discussions can really improve quality of life. We actually have what we call the Empower program, and we've done studies on trying to improve quality of life through different interventions, mostly talking about the stress and anxiety that goes with living with food allergy. And the third thing is that there are, I mean, I didn't have this to talk about decades ago. I mean, there are prevention strategies that can actually work, and there are treatment strategies that can actually work beyond just avoidance. Although most people will undertake avoidance and not treatment, there are treatments that have emerged and more to come. So those are the three things where you could really, you know, do yourself or your family member well to address them.
Those are great. Those are great points. We're going to make sure our audience hears about that. We've reached the point in the show where we turn to our most important guests, which are our subscribers out there. So we're going to tee up those questions. I always make the point that the podcast is for informational purposes, not in the place of a doctor's visit. And today we've spoken about a lot of medical issues. So it's important to listen to your doctor. They know your medical history. I mean, I listen to my doctor. My doctor's right here on the screen with me, or my child's doctor's right here. So I listen all the time. So let's hear from our subscribers. Kat, do you want to put our first subscriber on, or Kat usually has the first question? So what's
and
up?
And lucky for you, I'm the first question today.
Excellent.
And I know you both just emphasized the need to go to your doctor, get a proper diagnosis, but I'm wondering if at-home allergy tests are something that are useful, accurate, to sort of like get yourself a little more information before you schedule a doctor's appointment to get all of the allergy testing done. I'm just wondering.
Thank you for that question. Thank you for that question. There are a lot of places that are saying, oh, we'll come to your house, draw your blood, or send something away. This is not something that any of the board certified allergists are recommending that I know of. And it goes into also the category that I mentioned at the very beginning, that these tests are not like a pregnancy test. It's not a yes, no test. You really need a physician to figure out what tests should be ordered. Unfortunately, the companies that make even the standard tests make them in panels in some cases. So it makes it easier for a general physician to order a panel of foods, but that would include foods you're eating. And then someone sees, oh, I tested positive to this food that I eat, I better stop eating it. And that could actually be completely counterproductive. You know, if you take a food out of your diet strictly and have some positive test to it, you might become allergic to it, you know, in a year or two. So these are all potentially dangerous, and they could really mess up quality of life. And so I would be careful about any of that.
That's fantastic. Now that I know they're available everywhere, and so I'm thinking that I'm getting allergies and I'm concerned about growing into an allergy, and I was thinking about it, but now I'm just going to go to my doctor. So thank you for that.
It's everywhere.
I mean, I think the last one I saw was like Everly Well or something, and it's all the time. But I did not get any other questions in the chat for today. So Dr. Z, I'm going to give it back to you.
Thank you. These are amazing issues that we need to address as physicians, as those who deal with both children and adults, but surely children. And you mentioned a little bit about the school. environment and the work environment, as we were talking about. But thank you. You essentially have summarized a college course on food allergies in 30 or so minutes. That's just awesome. I mean, I'm sure those who watch this will have a lot of other questions that they can ask their doctor, but at least they understand where we are. And I have to ask one question?
Yes,
sure. Absolutely.
I'll ask myself a question. One topic that we didn't cover is the most common kind of allergy out there. And that's what we call pollen food allergy syndrome, which is that about 10% of the population gets an itchy mouth from various rough fruits and vegetables. And that category of allergy happens because first you get allergic to the protein and the pollen that's floating in the air. Your immune system is making those antibodies I showed you against a segment of that pollen protein, and nature has put that same protein in a lot of foods. So for example, with birch pollen, that same protein is in carrots, it's in apples, pears, peaches, cherries, and a whole bunch of other foods. And when they're raw, that protein, like you don't, in the pollen season, you don't lick your car clean, but if you did, your tongue would be itchy and your mouth would be itchy. And when you bite into the peach, you're getting a mouthful of that stuff. And for most people, it causes itchy mouth, maybe a little lip swelling, itchy throat. For sometimes people will get a more serious reaction from it. And cooking the food breaks that down. So most people who have this, if they have applesauce, they're fine. If they have peach pie, they're fine. The cooking breaks down that protein. I just wanted to throw that in because it's something that probably someone would have asked that I was expecting they would ask if we had a caller on, because it is the most common thing. People's like, oh, and so again, talk to your doctor about it. Most people don't get into trouble with it, but if you're like, you control it, like, oh, I'm a little itchy, so I'm going to stop eating it, or you just do what you're comfortable with. But some people get tricked. They get a fruit smoothie, raw, ice cold, straw, drink it fast. Now all of a sudden your stomach is full of like three raw peaches and you start vomiting and breaking out in hives. So it's something to still talk to your doctor about. And it's the management of it varies on how significant it is for that person.
I'm so
just throwing that in there. I wanted to be complete.
Thrilled you brought that up, because I have two people that I know who've had that exact problem with some of these raw, you know, fruits that's exactly happening. Yeah.
If we have an extra minute, there's this other weird thing where people who get, there are people like, hey, you know, I go to bed and I wake up vomiting like crazy and have hives. And most allergic reactions happen minutes or within an hour since you've eaten the food. Like you have your peanut and usually within 10 minutes, you're getting symptoms that I described earlier. But there's this weird allergy that's called alpha-gal. And people who get tick bites from particular ticks, they make an immune response against a sugar moiety in there, like a special sugar structure. And that is in mammalian meats, like in pork and beef. It's especially in some organ meats, like kidney, if you eat that. And so it can cause the allergic reaction, but the weird part is it's delayed. So it could happen like 3, 4, 5, 6 hours afterwards. So that's another odd one. There's also something called food protein-induced enterocolitis syndrome, or FPIES, where younger kids typically, but some adults also, will eat any food, not every food, a particular food for them, and vomit like crazy 2 hours later. Sometimes they get a low blood pressure along with that. And that's a different kind of food allergy that a lot of people aren't familiar with, and they think there's something crazy. Like, why is it that every time I eat clams, or oysters, this happens to me? I must be getting poisoned by it. But this classic 2 hour delay and then a bunch of GI symptoms and feeling really ucky and lethargic, or a baby who maybe gets rice cereal and has those symptoms 2 hours later, it's not your imagination. Talk to your pediatrician, your doctor, or allergist about it.
Great point. And it's almost like our immune system is trying, our body is trying to protect us against something that our immune system has decided to react to. And so, you know, spit it up, throw it up, get it out of your system. But and the immune system is fascinating. The whole world, one day we'll do a whole podcast just on the immune system and what it does and how it works, because, you know, we've had different conversations on different areas, and it always sort of comes back to, you know, what our body does and how it reacts to foreign substances. And in some ways, the food is a little bit of foreign substance to our body.
Absolutely.
But, right? I will say, as a parent, I have triple check labels. I've packed the allergy safe snacks in the lunchbox. I've worried about birthday parties. So it really is reassuring to hear, how the field keeps evolving and the new therapies that may be on the horizon. So I thank you. I thank you on a personal note for what you and your entire team have done to care for my child. It means the world to my entire family. So I really appreciate that. And this has been a fascinating discussion about food. Well, that's our show for today. Next time, I'm going to tell you on Docology, we're going to hear from the author of the book, the New York Times bestselling book called The Mosquito. And it's almost summertime now. We've spoken about some of the other challenges with pollen in the air. But mosquitoes, those are those little pesky little bugs that keep coming after us. Well, wait until you hear about how they have changed history. They have changed history more than I believe any politician has ever done. So as a little teaser, like the trailer for a movie, did you know that of all the people that have ever lived on the planet, a mosquito-transmitted illness killed half of them? That is really amazing that those little buggers have done such a damage over the course of history. But remember, if you are a Docology subscriber, you can join the show. You just have to click on the link in the bio and tune in next time, because the topic we cover may just save your life.
Docology is a production of Hang Media. Our producer is Catherine Warren. Ronnie Selig is editorial advisor. Our creative director is Anna Richard. Janine Wilson of Wilson Media Group handles paid marketing. Our publicists are Leslie Ann Wade and Jerry Caracoli. Theme music was composed by Nick Kitts. Subscribe and join our community at docology.life. Until next time, move, wash your hands, and stay healthy.